Brockman fitting up ahead to Gerstner. Noah open, spinning, layup in with 6 seconds remaining. Noah has 10 straight for Beloit. 3 seconds to play. Half-court shot from Harmison out of bounds off the miss, and we've hit halftime. What a finish to that first half for Noah Gerstner and the Beloit Trojans as they lead 26-5 at the break.
And Beloit does win last night. The boys do, going away 53-28 over Riley County, a balanced scoring attack led by junior Quinn Eilert with 12 and sophomore Eli Johnson with 11, which I believe is a new career high for him, and 10 points for a kid named Gerstner, who had all 10 in about 90 seconds, and then that's it. He checked out, didn't score for, 30 and a half minutes. He didn't score a point. But he scored 10 in about a minute and a half, which were important points because it was not a pretty game offensively last night in the boys' game, much like the Ellsworth boys' game the other night. And it was 16-5, and then Noah got a layup, then he hit a three, then he hit another three, and then he hit a layup right before the break, as you heard, 10 points in a quick period of time. That helps push the lead up to from 11 to 21, and Beloit never looked back after that and balanced attack, and their top two scorers didn't have a big night, which is fine when you have other guys that step up. And last night, Quinn Eilert and Eli Johnson, Noah Gerstner did step up offensively, and Beloit wins 53-28. They won three in a row. They're 3-3.
It's always kind of fun to have a little spurt like that, where you score points in a row, and right there in a row like that. Didn't happen that much for me, but the couple times it did, it was fun.
Yeah, I was talking with somebody in the stands. I got to be a parent last night, and I was talking to another parent. And we were talking, I'll just say who it was. It was Pat Gray, and his daughter Dakota was playing, and she had a nice rebound and stick back or something. I said, just like Dad, except Dad would have dunked it, right? He goes, yeah, right. I probably wouldn't even got the rebound. And then we started talking, a few of us in the stands. You know, as you get older, you can exaggerate these stories.
Right.
And if you're not from Beloit, I'm a transplant. So nobody has no idea whether I'm full of baloney or not. If I said I made 14 threes in a game, and it might have actually been four.
I mean, just trying to be humble here.
But people tend to exaggerate. You know, when I was in school, we walked naked in a snowstorm up a hill that was 1,000 feet tall. And then the story just gets bigger and bigger and better and ever. And what really happened was you had to go outside and walk 100 feet.
Yeah.
You know, get in the car that didn't have the remote start, and you somehow got through it.
I joke that I have a record that will never be broken at Oxford High School. Tied for a record. 3 interceptions in one game.
Are you Al Bundy? 4 touchdowns?
The fact that, you know, there is no more Oxford High School. You know, it is now consolidated. But, you know, I leave that part out usually when I tell that story. So, yeah.
Well, it's important that you leave out stuff that doesn't incriminate you. And if you can exaggerate, nobody double checks seems to be what happens now today in society. Just say whatever you want because you feel like nobody's going to take the time to check it. And even if you do, you just say it's not true. Then, of course, it is true because you say it's not true. Whatever. I know. It is what it is. But last night, the Beloit girls, they fell to Riley County. Man, the Riley County girls, they look good. Riley County girls. One thing that stood out about me about them last night is, one, they got a point guard that has played 4 years, and she's very experienced. She's very good. But they just were so good. They played 5 out, and they just passed and cut you to death. And they move without the ball very well. They don't really have a bona fide post player. They move the ball well. Their pressure causes turnovers. They find the open person. Their spacing is really good. And they're just fundamentally sound. And for Beloit, certainly a lot of experiences we talked about and kind of behind the eight ball a little bit to start the year as various reasons we've talked about too. And they've been improving offensively. Last night it was tough against a team that really got after it defensively. But also Beloit had, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 layups that if they make some of those layups, that game is a little bit different. Definitely at halftime it's different. And there was a lid on the bucket from point blank range last night. And then of course the turnovers hurt too when you're playing against a team that likes to pressure, and then they get easy buckets off of that. So the Beloit girls now 2-4 on the season. The Beloit boys have won 3 in a row. They're 3-3. Did Beloit have anybody in double figures in the girls game?
They did not.
I didn't think so. They only 21 points. They struggled offensively last night. So that's the last games before the Christmas break. I just want to say one thing here, and this is going to be, you know, this is coming as a parent, okay? So it is interesting how people see a game. You can figure out who are the real diehard basketball fans based on how they know the game. And then you can tell what fans really don't know the game when they're screaming about rules they don't know, things like that. You know, we've talked about that over the years. And so one of the things, like, you know, I'll just use my family as an example, okay? And I could use others, certainly. But last night, as we talked about, my son scored 10 points in a row, and then he didn't score before that. He didn't score after that, right? He scored 10 points in like 90 seconds, whatever it was. That was important. It helped the team win. And all he cares about is winning. He's not worried about how many shots he gets. He's not worried about how many points he scores and so forth and so on. He, you know, the ultimate goal is to win. Now, as a team, Beloit continues to not shoot the ball well from three. They were 3 of 18 last night, and that will get better. Trust me. I'm just waiting for the game where Beloit shooting guards are on, because when it is, when it happens, it's going to be glorious and fun to watch, and then everything's going to open up for Beisner and Johnson inside when Beloit starts knocking some of those shots on the outside, and it's going to happen. We've seen Wyatt do it in a stretch in a game. We've seen Noah do it in a stretch in a game. We've seen Quinn knock down a couple. He's starting to shoot the ball better, too, because he, Wyatt, and Noah all struggled early in the year, and they've kind of been up and down, all three of them, in regards to shooting. But once they figure it out, and they will, then this team's going to be, you know, a lot better offensively. So it'd be easy as a parent to you know splash it all over social media and brag about, hey, my kid scored 10 points in a row, or hey, we won, and so forth and so on, or oh, hey, we had a last second layup or hit a couple threes or whatever else. You know what I'm most proud of about my son last night? I'm just going to speak as a parent, and hopefully he's not listening, because I embarrass him when I talk about him. And but, you know, it's the beauty of the job that I have. I have this platform that I don't take I don't take seriously. I take seriously. There's every once in a while I probably don't. But the thing I'm most proud of, that I will bet you nobody else in the stands saw or noticed, but I did. And I think my wife did. And my wife's not the biggest sports fan in the world. She doesn't know the intricacies of any of this stuff. I will be willing to bet the coaches noticed it, but they might not have. But the thing I'm most proud of my son and what he did last night has nothing to do with shooting the basketball, has nothing to do with scoring points. It really necessarily doesn't have anything in regards to winning the game. But one of the things we've established over the years, I've helped coach some of these kids. Coach Eilert and I coach the Ballers. Coach Beisner's helped a little bit over the years with the Ballers, too. We call them the Ballers basketball organization that Beloit has. And we've coached these kids since they were third grade, the junior class. So I'm very familiar with all those kids in my son's class, and coached them when they were little scrawny kids. And now they've grown into young adults, young men. And we have talked and we have preached and we have screamed, and it's been in baseball, it's been in football, it's been in basketball, about somebody needs to provide leadership. You know, somebody's got to become vocal. And that's still really, honestly, I haven't fully seen it from that class, but I've seen flashes of it. I always think it's a lot easier to be a leader when you're on the floor. It's hard to do it from the bench. And coaches can't tell you everything. You need a quarterback on the floor. Usually in basketball, that quarterback is your point guard. Usually the leader of your team, I think, usually needs to be your point guard. Doesn't have to be, but usually it's your point guard. Kind of like football team, usually your leader probably should, the quarterback should be one of those leaders. Now, it's tough if you're a freshman or sophomore, a young player. Same thing, a point guard. If you don't have me, if you have no seniors on your roster, somebody's got to provide leadership. Obviously, Southeast Saline had that last year. May it got third at state, and they had no seniors. So obviously, somebody stepped up to be a leader. And the thing I'm most proud of my son yesterday, and I will be willing to bet you almost everybody in the stands missed it. And no, I'm not going to go put it all over social media. This is my platform. I do it, okay? And that is, he was in the game running the point there in the fourth quarter, and Abe Staples is in the game. Abe is a great kid. He is a senior. He doesn't get to play very much. Okay, but he is a team player. He is always cheering the team on. He is, his teammates really respect him and enjoy him. And my son comes down with the ball in his hands, and to me, this is a form of leadership, and this is the thing I'm most proud of him last night. And I hope other teams, I'm sure there's other teams that do this and players do this, but it was really nice. He took charge, and he basically told everybody to clear out so that he could throw the ball to Abe in the post, so Abe could post up and try to get a bucket. He did that on his own, from what I understand and from what I see. Okay? And that's a form of leadership. That is a form of leadership. I'm the point guard. I'm bringing the ball up the floor. And you know what? There are guards in those situations. They're like, I'm all about mine. It's a blowout. I'm going to get mine. I'm going to chuck a three. I'm going to force it. I'm going to drive it, throw up a wild shot, try to get fouled. Or you might just pass it to your buddy on the team. But no, no, this is the opportunity. And I think he gets it from watching KU basketball and other teams where you see the walk-ons come in and you're trying to get them a shot and you're being unselfish. And the bench goes nuts when it happens, right? We've seen it at every level of sports. We go nuts when the freshman runs in a touchdown from 90 yards like Joel Rex wrote. And I saw the bench going nuts this year for Beloit, you know? And I've seen it before in various sports where you go nuts when the kid that hasn't played the baseball game all night, hardly played at all year, he gets to go to the plate and he gets a little bloop hit or whatever. He gets a base hit or steals a base. And everybody's going nuts because they're happy for that person, which means that you have good team morale. It means that the team is into it and they care. And that means also it's a huge compliment to that person that maybe doesn't play a lot, but has stuck it out. And so I'm really proud of my son for doing that because there are a lot of kids that would not have done that. And it's a blowout game, could easily be selfish, try to get yours. And he just was like, he told the team, you know, get out of the way here. He just kind of used his left arm like to clear out. Let Abe post, and I'm going to get it to Abe. And he got it. Abe turned. I was pulling for him to make the shot. He didn't make the shot, but man, I wanted him to make it so bad. And I'm pretty sure everybody on that bench wanted him to make it really badly, too. And I know my son wanted him to make it. And so anytime kids that don't get to play a lot at the varsity level, whether seniors, juniors, sophomores, or freshmen, when they get to come in and they get a chance to score, it's really cool to see teams really excited about that. And so I told him that last night, a little inside information. I just said, you know what, of all the things you did last night, I'm most proud of the fact that you took charge, which is a sign of leadership, and you made sure that Abe got a touch so he could have a chance to score. I think that is tremendous, and I would like to see more teams do those type of things, and some teams do, don't get me wrong, but I do think that it points to a good morale of your team. I think it points to the character of your team, and I'd be willing that there's other players on the team that have rubbed off the right way on my son over the last few years to where he would have the presence of mind to do that. And I'm not saying other players on the team wouldn't do that. They would.
Yeah.
But in this case, he happened to have
the ball
and he's the one that made that decision, and I loved it.
Yeah.
That's a sign of leadership.
There's always, I've been on teams like that too, where even when I was in high school, right, we had a kid that was a couple years older than me that was in my sister's class, and he was a heck of a football player, a bruiser on the football field. He was actually a pretty good athlete, but he just didn't have basketball skills, right?
Sure, like, some people are just better.
So he would only get in if it was, well, unfortunately for us, it was a blowout the wrong way most of the time.
But you're down 30.
Yeah, he would get in, you know, at the end of the game and go and do his bruising thing, right? But if he would get the ball and get a bucket, I mean, the whole student section went nuts because Robert Uhl scored, right? Like, we loved him. Like, we all loved him. He's one of the nicest guys in the world. I'm sure he compares a lot to Abe, right?
Yeah.
As far as how he is as a human being. Like, everybody loved him. Nobody disliked Robert. And when he got in the game and got a bucket at the end of the game, people would just go nuts. That, first of all, they would start chanting his name right when he got into the game.
Which is awesome.
And so they'd be yelling and screaming, get him the ball, and things like that. And then, you know, when he scored, it just erupted, right? And he would, about every game, get at least open enough for a layup and get a bucket almost every time he went in at the end of the game. And so it is fun to see that. And I've seen actually a couple teams here this year where they're seniors that don't get to play a lot, but when they get that opportunity, and I've seen it with a team that's obviously better and has that lead at the end of the game. It wasn't like my situation where you're losing at the end of the game.
Right.
And they try to get the senior the ball and let him get a bucket. And you can tell that the crowd, the students, the rest of the team, they want him to score and they want him to get in there. And so it is fun to see that and see that people actually take that to note instead of being like, oh, hey, I just want to get my points here because it's a 30-point blowout and I can go score easy here. And so it is something that you know, other players have to take account for and understand the situation, too. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Noah knew that last night. And there's a lot of people that I've seen here in those situations that understand what you need to do there and try to make this a memorable moment for somebody that doesn't get one a whole lot.
Right. Sometimes coaches will kind of, you know, try to tell you to do that, but I don't believe that happened last night, which is fine. I think it's great.
Exactly.
See, the one thing that I've talked about and I've talked with various coaches, including those that I mentioned earlier, is that when you're on the sideline coaching, you can tell people where to be, you can direct traffic, and you try to be a leader, and you try to say as much as you can. But at some point, the people on the floor have to take ownership of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean by leadership. So, and I believe, if I remember correctly, I think Wyatt did a very similar thing for Seth Kahn last year. Got the ball into him late in the game, so they were trying to get him the ball and get a bucket. So whether the coach orients it or whether the players, I think it means even more if the players can do it on their own without the coach telling them to do it. That to me, is owning it.
Absolutely.
So anyway, the Beloit boys won last night. The balanced scoring attack, as I already went through, the Beloit girls fall. Anything else from basketball last night?
I do want to add one other thing about that girls game, because you were talking about the pressure that Riley County brought to the mm-hmm. table. One of the things that impressed me about Riley County is it's been a long time since I've seen a team switch half-court defenses as much as they were last
night. Yeah, they were.
They went from man to 2-3 to 1-3-1. And the reason I say that is because even though they're winning by 20, 30 points, mm-hmm. that's an opportunity for you to work on
something.
And to learn what you need to do in this defense. Mm-hmm. I saw a team earlier this year that was running a straight 2-3, full-court press the whole game. Against Stockton, I'll say that, and never changed what they were doing. I'm like, would this be a good chance to
work on
maybe work stuff on a man-to-man or something?
Right.
And that's why I point that out, because I think Kelsey Nelson's a basketball player. She's a coach.
Yeah.
She knows what she's doing,
yeah,
right?
She
like,
does.
Played 2 years at Cloud, played at K-State. So, you know, I know she knows basketball and what she's doing, mm-hmm. and she knows that's an opportunity for her team to get better and
yeah.
learn and understand how to play three different defenses
mm-hmm.
and be very effective in playing mm-hmm. three different defenses, because
right.
you might need that. When you get to the postseason,
right.
man might not work against this team. You might have to run that 1-3-1 trap, or you might have to run the 2-3, and
mm-hmm.
who knows? Maybe she's got a 3-2 that she kept in her back pocket from last
right.
night, but I did want to point that out, because I think there's a lot of coaches that when you get into a game where you're winning big, you just don't care anymore. You just
yeah.
you just do what you do, and
mm-hmm.
then we take this as we blew this team out, and it doesn't matter. We're winning this game. But for a team like that, if you want to get where you want to get, you got to learn a lot of different things and get yourself better. And I thought that was impressive.
How many times do we see in 8-man football where there's a team that could easily finish it at halftime, easily could finish it in the third quarter, and they make sure, the coach does, as long as he has enough kids on the roster.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have 11 on the team, you want to finish it early. But if you got like 20 on the roster or more, and you're playing 8-man football, and you're up by 38, 40 points, something like that, late in the second quarter, third quarter, coaches are fairly good if they really focus on it. And I know some that are really good at it and some that don't seem to care. And that is, you utilize as much of the game as you can, if not the entire rest of the game. And it might drive a radio broadcaster nuts because we want to go home and it's a 40-point
yeah.
game. It might drive the fans nuts. Oh, it's kind of cold out here. I want to go home. But that is a great opportunity. It's no different than a blowout in a basketball game at halftime of the third quarter, even a running clock in the fourth quarter. It's a great opportunity to work on things, but it's also a great opportunity to give other kids an opportunity to get some valuable experience. And because if you just go ahead and blow somebody out at halftime and you got 12, 14 kids on the sideline, don't get in, they could have had experience. And so that's extra practice time is what that really is.
Mm-hmm.
How many times do we hear from football teams, and we hear it from basketball coaches too, that when you go deep in the state, you get more practices. Okay. When you go to a bowl game, you get more practices in college football. That helps develop your team. Now, maybe not as much as it once was if you got lots of people transferring out and all that stuff in the transfer portal. But the point still is that you utilize as much of your time as you can. And that's what you're saying with Riley County. Same thing applies to a team way up in basketball, or baseball's the same way. You can work on situations. You know, when it's 12-0, you might be able to work on a hit and run.
Mm-hmm.
You might be, I mean, your game's over. You're up 12-0. Chance to work on a hit and run. Maybe it's a chance to put a kid in at a position that you've always wanted to see him play and see how he handles a game situation. There's so many things you can utilize as a coach. And there are some coaches that are fantastic at it, and there's others that just flat out waste it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that. One more thing I want to say about Riley County girls that really impressed me last night, and I said it to Jason earlier. they're fundamentally sound.
Yeah.
They moved the ball well. They played five out most of the night, and they passed and cut you to death. And they handle the ball well, and they find the open person. Their eyes are up almost all the time. Their vision is very good. They rebound well for not being that big of a team. Their defensive pressure is really good without fouling and getting in all kind of foul trouble. They pressure you, and then they immediately take that, and they're looking up the floor. They're not satisfied with turnover. They're looking at quick offense. And you can tell that is a team that is fundamentally sound. And they have a point guard that is very, very experienced. That doesn't hurt either. But that didn't just start with Kelsey Nelson, okay?
No.
Let me go back, and I'm not trying to take a shot at all.
Exactly,
Nelson's absolutely fantastic coach, but I want to extend upon this. This is one of the things, and you could, I might be dead wrong when I say this, but one of the things that I try to stress, I'm coaching some third graders right now, okay? I help coach some other kids, and I'm by far I have a lot to learn when I coach at any level doing anything. And remember, I'm a volunteer. It doesn't get paid, okay? And other people usually don't step up to the plate. And so if you're going to get mad at me because something happens with the team, well, I'll be happy to hand you the whistle, and you can do it anytime you want. Now, we do criticize college and pro coaches. They're getting paid millions of dollars, all right, to get it right, as they say. But I'm not paid nothing. Ryan Eilert's not paid much to be the high school coach. Sean Arimas, Scott Jermark, name any coach, all right? Yeah. Any coach imaginable, all right? Lance and Leah Bergman, whoever it might be. Nick Lynn, they're not paid tons of money to get these things right. They are we figured it out. They probably are making about $1 an hour if they're lucky for all the time they spend. Mm-hmm. And then how much time they spend laying in bed after a tough loss going, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Or what could I have done differently? I do that, and freaking I'm coaching 9-year-olds sometimes. But the thing that and I learned this from other coaches when I was trying to learn how to coach, and hopefully I can pass that along. And like I said, I have a long way to go if I want to be a better coach myself. But so many people are caught up in scrimmage, 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 game, 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 tournament, tournament, tournament. Okay, that's the test, right? That's the test. But it's just like education. Sports is no different than education. You have practices, right? You have your homework, you study your subject, and then you get ready for the big quiz or the big test, and that's how you ultimately are graded, okay? Same thing with sports. You're ultimately, the game is the test. And you either pass or you fail, whatever the case may be. It's pretty simple. It's a pass or a fail. You win or you lose. But there's lots of intricacies as to, you did get a good grade. You know, you played really good shortstop, or you played really good point guard. You did a wonderful job at corner in the secondary, or at linebacker. We could go on. You know, you did a wonderful job, you know, pinning that guy in wrestling, and after you got pinned earlier by the same guy a week ago, and you've made so many strides. But it's practices. I know Allen Iverson said we're talking about practice, but practice is very important. And to me, the fundamentals are so, so important. And what this goes all the way down. This is what I think, and I don't know if any high school coach out there listening right now will disagree with me or not, but this is what I believe, and from what other coaches I've talked to, they understand the importance of it. And we've definitely seen it with Smith Center football. Is a great example, a fantastic example, Smith Center football, over the years. But if you can have the people in place to not be all caught up in let's play games and tournaments all the time, yes, you sprinkle them in, but if you actually focus on the fundamentals of practice instead of rolling the ball out and just go 5-on-5 and let them go nuts. But you work on the fundamentals, and I'll use basketball because that's what I'm coaching right now. If you focus on the fundamentals of basketball with these kids when they are 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, all right, that is a good start. Now, I'm not saying they're going to be world beaters. They may not be able to really pick it up and do the fundamentals right ever. They might be late bloomers. They may be really good at it. But the point is, you've got, in order to do things the right way, it helps to not develop bad habits. It helps to learn it the right way initially, okay? And if you can learn it the right way, the fundamentals of anything in life, let alone sports, you're going to be better off for it. And so it is the job of, like, there's nothing official when you're dealing with 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th grade. All right. But then you go into junior high, and it is the responsibility of junior high coaches. I truly believe this. And this applies to every sport imaginable. It's wrestling, basketball, football, volleyball. I don't care what sport you want to talk about. All right. If you have junior high tennis, junior high golf, the job of the junior high coaches is to help prepare these players with the fundamentals and the tools so that when they get to high school, the high school coaches have something to work with from the very beginning. Like, they don't have to reteach everything. Mm-hmm. They should be able to go, okay, you know how, you know where to go on a 2-3 zone. You know how to help when somebody gets beat off the dribble in man-to-man. You know to how to close out on a shooter, you know, or you know the terminology of the floor. Like, you actually know where the block is. You know what the sideline is and the baseline. And that sounds really trivial and stupid. You might say, that's simple. No, no, no. Believe it or not, there are some people, even in high school, that don't know all the terminology of the sport. And to me, that's a failure of everybody that coached them all the way up until they got to high school. I'm not saying it's one person. It could have been the fourth grade coach. Could have been the second grade coach. Can be the junior high coach. But the junior high coaches are the last ones that coach before high school. So there is a big responsibility, and I think some junior high coaches understand that. I think some don't have any clue as to that's what you're doing. You're supposed to help bridge the gap, speed up the process, and have them ready so that when they step on the floor as freshmen, they at least have a chance to help the team, whether it's in scouts, as a second team in practice against the varsity and the seniors and juniors, whether it's to, you know, they end up taking 2 or 3 years to fully develop, but they at least have a head start. But there's nothing worse for and you see it with these programs that are bad year in and year out. They have what? They usually lack stability. They change coaches all the bleeping time. They change coaches all the time in junior high. They change coaches all the time in high school. The school board blows out a coach because they're not happy with them, or one person whines and the wrong person gets upset on the school board and gets somebody canned. And it hurts your program when you do those things. You have to have consistency. Smith Center, for all these years, these kids, when they're really, really young, already are learning how to run the Smith Center offense. They did with Roger Barta. And Roger Barta wasn't coaching the little kids all the time, but they knew, we're running Wishbone, and it works at Smith Center, Kansas. And boy, did it ever. But these kids don't show up at day one of practice with Roger Barta when he coached and just didn't know anything about the Wishbone.
Yeah,
they were already primed, whether it was tackle football like the Buccaneer program that Beloit has or whatever, you know. Peewee football, whatever level it is, and I'm going back to football now, but whatever the sport it is amazing when you have the consistency of coaches at not just a high school level, but further down, as long as they can work together. And I think it's very important that junior high coaches work well with their high school coaches and vice versa, and communicate and talk a little bit, because that is an extension of your high school sports program, is your junior high kids. Now, some of these kids, junior high, they're going to discover, you know what, basketball ain't my thing. Football ain't my thing. Wrestling ain't my thing. Tennis ain't my thing. My volleyball's not my thing. Okay, eventually you weed people out, and they might specialize. They might not specialize. They might play every sport. But the point is that they're better prepared. And that's one thing I take pride in. I like to think, and maybe I'm a stooge and I'm a moron, okay? But I like to think that I had just a tiny, tiny sliver of help in seeing the development of kids that I coached way back, no matter what sport it is. When I go watch Beloit play high school baseball, or I watch the football team and I help flag football way back, and I look at Grady Seifert, who I helped coach one time. I have nothing to do with Grady Seifert's development, okay? He's just, that's all about Casey and his dad, I'm sure. But my point being is that I like to think, and that's the reward, I think, as a coach. I don't get paid. I don't know if I speak for other volunteer coaches out there. You know, we talk about all the negativity, right? Parents are screaming and yelling at you, and you get to a point where you get fed up and say it's not worth it. We say the same thing with officiating as well. But the rewarding thing to me when I help coach, and I encourage other people to step up and volunteer to coach. I know it's not easy. You can't please everybody. And if you think you can, then you shouldn't probably do it. But at the end of the day, the thing I look at is my payment and my reward is seeing these kids develop. And if I see, you know, I look at Lance Lundeen. Lance Lundeen is a great example. Lance Lundeen, and I don't know if his mom and dad are listening right now. I know his mom and dad very well, coached Lance for sports for years. And listen, Lance is no different than any other kid that I've coached. There's times that you just want to pull your hair out. Okay, you just want to scream. You want to go into a closed door room and you want to scream. Whether it's my son or whoever's son But I'm using Lance Lindeen as an example, not to point out that I pulled my hair out all the time with Lance, because Lance does lots of good things, and whatever he's developed into an unbelievable cross-country runner, mm-hmm. all right? He's a solid baseball player. I called him Stretch. He made so many plays at first base for us in Pee Wee baseball. I'll never forget some of the plays he made. Okay, but he basketball-wise, he was behind. No, listen, he was well behind some of these kids. Kyler Burks is another one. Kyler Burks was well behind the curve of some of the other kids in his class in regards to his basketball skill. But this is why, and this is what I want to warn people, because I hear it all the time, and I saw it when I started coaching these kids back then, and I see it with kids now, is there's parents already trying to forecast what position their kid's going to play when they're 17, and right now they're 10. Mm-hmm. And that's just ludicrous and silly and a waste of time, because these kids are going to play different positions in many cases when they get to high school. They're going to be forced to if they want to play, because there's another kid in their spot. And I hear people say, well, we need to have kids learn a certain position when they play peewee baseball. We need to have a kid that has to learn a certain position when they play flag football. No, no, no. You're doing a more harm than good when you do that. You need them to play, probably learn two or three positions, if not more. Rotate kids around to get familiar with different positions, because they're going to have to learn different positions. It is inevitable. It's going to happen, okay? So getting back to Lance Lindeen, I watched Lance last night, and he is developed into a energy player. He is active defensively, mm-hmm. and made a nice full court layup that I'm going to tell you, and his mom and dad will not disagree when I say this. Every year I coached him, help coach. I wasn't the head coach. The reason he missed layups was because his head coach, not me. I was assistant. I had nothing to do with him. If that head coach is listening right now, he's going to say, yeah, right. But anyway, Lance probably, when he was younger, he'd miss that layup every time. Oh, not every time. Almost every time. Okay. But Lance last night did it like he's done it for years. Like mm-hmm. he did it perfectly when he's fifth grade. And trust me, he didn't. But he's developed to where he can go down the floor and make a left-hand layup look easy. Now, he is left-handed. And so that's an example. Kyler Burks, what he did last year before he had the horrible car accident this summer. The amazing development I've seen. I've seen development in, you know, Bryce and Quinn and Noah and other kids. And I use these names because I know those kids. But if you're listening out there and you coach, all you got to do is plug in different names for the people I'm talking about. And so the payment for me, there's no money involved. No boosters pay me a lot of money to coach. But the payment for me is watching last night and seeing a Lance Lindeen do that. It's watching a Kyler Burks develop, you know, last year into a really good role player. It's watching a Bryce Beisner get physical and aggressive instead of being so nice, as we talked about for years with mm-hmm. him. It's watching my son say, get out of the way, I'm getting it to Abe Staples because he deserves a shot. It's watching, you know, Quinn Eilert get deflections and get after it aggressively. I mean, it's watching Eli Johnson get fired up. I coached him a little bit in baseball, and there's times where I'd have to get on Eli. Eli, hustle, hurry up. And I see Eli sprinting down the floor after he might miss a shot, and then he gets a rebound or a block shot. You know, it's Jackson Cheney that, you know, makes a really smart, heady play, or he goes sets a screen for somebody when he doesn't have to, but I noticed he did during the game last night when other teammates of his did not. And they're going that way anyway. Why not set a screen to free up your teammate? And he did. I see those little things. I don't see every little thing. But that, to me, is the payment. That, to me, I like to think, and like I said, maybe I'm a stooge for thinking it, but I like to think, and I've got my thumb and my index finger together, and there's barely, it's like credit card ups, as we like to say. Yeah, Gershner had a credit card ups, because that's all I could do for jumping. But that's the only payment I need. That's the payment for years of helping with kids, is seeing them develop to where maybe they don't make contributions at the varsity level. Maybe it's a different sport. Maybe I had something to do with them becoming, you know, good character kids. Maybe I had nothing to do with it. I have no idea, but I like to think I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reward of coaching. And you may say, man, some of these people, why in the heck do they coach? That just seems like a crazy thing. I would never do it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the reward. Watching these kids then eventually graduate, which is going to be really interesting for me to watch this class, including my own, graduate, and then remembering where they were and how they started, and doesn't seem that long ago, and seeing them develop into good young men, good citizens, and good people doing good things. There's nothing that makes a parent feel better than when somebody you don't even know very well, and I had this happen recently, and I'm not bragging about my kid, I'm just using an example. Somebody told me, man, you know, I saw your oldest, and he is just so good with your brother, which our middle son has special needs. He has Down syndrome. That melts my heart. Ari, that makes me feel that means more to me than anything anybody could say about anything sports wise. But I like to think sports wise that intertwined and overlapped to help.
You learn a lot of things through sports with life too, right?
Absolutely.
Like with that part of it, right? It's funny that you brought up Lance, because I remember when we were coming back from the Concordia game, we were talking about on varsity who can be that like energy guy, that vocal leader, and just be just passionate and bring that energy. And I said, you know, I was watching Lance in that JV game, and he was bringing that.
Right.
But I got to thinking, I'm like, if you're as good as he is at cross country, you've got to be self-motivated.
Yes, you do.
And you've got to be able to pump yourself up, which understand you can take that to the next level and bring that to your teammates.
Right.
And I think Lance does a good job of that. Mm-hmm. As far as what I was watching JV, now he doesn't get the kind of minutes in varsity to probably be that kind of guy in a varsity game, but he can do it from the bench.
But he's starting to get a little bit more playing time as
he
goes. Yeah.
Exactly. And I see him doing it on the bench too, pumping his teammates up and things like that too. And when he gets into the game, he brings energy and passion and everything like that. So, I mean, if I can see that, obviously there's something there, because I haven't seen Lance grow up like you have. I mean, I've seen him play when I maybe would be at a baseball game watching Tyson, right? But Noah would be playing in the next one. I'd stick around and watch that group of kids play too, right? And so I see him grow up, but I don't see him every day like you do in practices, games, everything like that, basketball, baseball, whatever the sport may be. And so, yeah, it's an opportunity there where you get to actually see these kids get better and grow up.
Yeah, that's the reward.
Bring
that's
that energy, and that's what I like to see as well.
That's the reward. All right, any other scores from last night you want to go over, or did you go over all of them?
Concordia split with Clay Center last night. That was the only other games that were going on. 53-47 Concordia boys, and I don't remember the girls' score. I think it was 52-37 Clay Center.
And wrestling results, did we go through?
I have not. Those are all posted at ncksports.com. Let me pull those up real quick, and I can tell you how Beloit did. They went 2-2 on the day at the Republic County Holiday Duels as they let me get back to the wrestling part of this. They won over Nemaha Central to start the day and then lost to Concordia and Republic County in the middle. Third place match, they beat Hill City. 45-30. So,
All right. Locker room chats tonight.
Yeah, we'll talk coaches of Beloit, Osborne, Smith Center, and Thunder Ridge this evening around 5:15. Katie Country 94, katiecountry94.com. So,
we're going to do this as a rite of. I told Jason earlier, it's like the holidays. You know, Christmas comes once a year. Thanksgiving comes once a year. Halloween comes once a year. New Year's Eve comes once a year. And the annual bitching about the KBCA rankings comes once a year, at least. And the latest whiners of the rankings are the Southeast of Saline boys supporters. And I'm having fun with this because I understand their frustration. I've tried to tell them through Twitter, chill out. It's not the college football playoff where you're not going to be invited. The KBCA rankings, I'll say this again, we do this every year. They're not very indicative. They're not very accurate, per se, in regards to who the best teams are. In some cases, I had somebody tell me one time only 13 coaches turned in their rankings. All right? 13 coaches turned in their rankings. That's too bad Dusty's got to go because he could back me up on this. So there only 13 coaches turned the rankings one time, I was told. Now, do you think those 13 coaches have seen 10? The 10 ranked schools that they rank times the classes times girls and boys? No, of course not. No. They have no idea. They have no idea. In some cases, it's an assistant coach that will send in the vote and not the head coach. And, oh, yeah, you know that team's always really good. I'm going to put them in my top 10. I remember one time where the Beloit boys started the year ranked, lost two games in a row, started 0-2, and were still ranked. Makes no sense. Then they won like two or three in a row and fell out of the rankings. Like, what is the point of the rankings? So here's the angst. The new KBCA rankings came out yesterday, All right. And I've heard teams, I've heard our local fans do the same thing, complain and whine about, oh, our volleyball team should be ranked higher. Our football team isn't ranked high enough. There's people complaining about somebody's poll after the season when the football championship has been decided and somebody puts Beloit fifth instead of fourth. Oh, how could you put Beloit fifth in football instead of fourth? They're better than this other team. Who cares? They don't give out medals for fourth and fifth place in football, okay? They don't. They give out a trophy for the state championship. They give out trophies when you win sub-state, you win regionals, districts, things like that. But they don't give out a trophy for finishing fourth or fifth place in football at the end of the year. So if you're going to sit here and go whining about, well, somebody's postseason rankings has Beloit fifth instead of fourth, well, I'm going to be mad as heck about it. You didn't make the state championship game, all right? And even if you did, if you don't win at all, somebody could still put you at three because they think the state title game was the week before. I mean, you know, if somebody wanted to put Axtell and Canton Galva, how would you rank them at the end of this year? Thunder Ridge went to the state title game and got blown out. You know, it was a good game for a quarter and a half. They got blown out. That's a fact of life. Nobody can deny that. So at the end of the year, Axtell used your ranking as number one, right? Well, you got to put Thunder Ridge two. They made a state title. No, you don't. Canton Galva was the second best team, not Thunder Ridge. I'm not trying to make fun of Thunder Ridge. I'm just saying it's a fact. I mean, you ask the people that know football at Thunder Ridge, they will tell you. Canton Galva, yeah, they're better than us. They almost or could have or should have beat Axtell. Well, we made the state title game. How in the heck are we not ranked second? Or, well, we would have beat this team if we had a rematch. But you lost to him during the season. Doesn't that count for something? It doesn't matter. So the rankings, every year I hear people whine and bellyache and complain, and I know I'm whining and bellyache and complaining about the people that are complaining, so welcome to America. But the latest is Southeast Saline boys, and some of their fans and people are upset. And I get it. I agree with them. I want to preface this. I agree with them. But it's really a waste of time and energy. If this was the college football playoff, and they only choose four select schools for the college football invitational, as I call it, if the Kansas State High School Activity Association didn't have sub-states and regionals, and they just simply took the top four ranked teams in the state, and you're number five, now you should be whining and complaining about the rankings. But as long as you're in the top four, you're in. Well, that's not how we do it. The great thing about every sport imaginable on earth, except for the stupid college football playoffs system, which it isn't a playoff system, it's an invitational, is that we decide it. Like, we decide it. You're in regional rounds, you got to do that to get the sub-state. You got to get through sub-state to get the state. And then you win state. It's as simple as that. Every single school in the state of Kansas is in the postseason. Every single team. If you go 0-20, like Oberlin that Jason covered, they still get to be the 8th seed at sub-state. Yep. They still have a chance to go nuts and go crazy and win three games and go to state. Every single team. Every single school in the state of Kansas is in the playoffs. They are in the postseason. Every single one in basketball. In football, almost everybody is, okay? If you finish fifth or sixth in your district, you really shouldn't be complaining too much because you finished last year in your district, you don't deserve to go to the playoffs, that's for sure. But so here's the deal. Southeast Saline, I've seen them in person. They're the best team in the state, in my opinion. But I have not seen Sabetha play. I know Sabetha's loaded. I've seen some of their kids that played on my son's traveling team this summer in Manhattan. I've seen other kids that are older, seniors. They are loaded. They were very good in football. They got a great senior class. They have got some absolute talent. And I cannot tell you that Southeast would beat Sabetha head-to-head, just like I can't tell you Sabetha beat Southeast head-to-head. I have no idea, and it really doesn't matter until maybe they play at state. But here's the thing. Southeast Saline was ranked number one. They beat Heston, the previous number one. They beat them the first game of the year. Southeast immediately slides to number one. That's a no-brainer. They were two. They moved to one. They beat Heston head-to-head by double digits. Then Southeast goes out, and they beat a couple of ranked teams this past week. I mean, and they win easily. They win easily. They weren't really fully. They rolled Abilene, which is a bigger school, by the way. And Southeast Saline, after doing what they did, dropped from number one to number two. And Sabetha slides in the number one spot. Why? I have no idea. All I can tell you is that different coaches must have voted, more coaches voted, less coaches voted. A whole bunch of people in Northeast Kansas voted, and people in North Central Kansas didn't vote. I have no idea. So Southeast goes from number one to number two. It makes no sense. They shouldn't move at all. I totally agree with Southeast Saline fans. If there's anybody listening to the podcast online, anybody from the Gibson Salina area, listen, I am 100,000% behind you that you shouldn't have fallen from one to two. Totally agree. Having said that, rankings mean nothing. They absolutely mean jack squat, okay? You get seeded by your record when you go to sub-state. You don't get seeded by where KBCA has you ranked, okay? All you got to do is see volleyball. How many times you see volleyball? Three teams that are ranked in the top 10 in the same sub-state. That's when you should complain. Rankings, I mean, who cares? Southeast is going to probably be at state. They are a heavy favorite to win their sub-state, which Beloit's in, by the way. What you do is you use this as fuel and motivation if you're Southeast Saline. You actually, if I'm Bryson Flax, I love it. Mm-hmm. That gives my team more to be motivated about. Like, let's get that one spot back, or let's prove people wrong. But you know what I would be saying as a coach? Guys, chill out. Let your moms and dads bitch and moan and complain about the rankings as much as they want. But guys, it don't mean nothing. The only ranking that matters at the end of the year is when you're hoisting that state championship trophy above your head. Guess what? You don't need coaches to rank you then, do they? You already went out and proved it. And so I sent a text to Southeast Saline basketball Twitter account. I said, listen, I get your frustration. I hear you. But at the end of the day, this all gets settled on the court anyway. And rankings, I don't like them. I think it's stupid that we have rankings in college football before the season even begins. I think it's stupid we have rankings in college basketball before the season begins. I think it's stupid that we have high school rankings before the season begins. I think a power rankings in NFL before the season begins. I think it's all stupid. I think you should wait at least a month and start to see what these teams are like so that you don't punish teams that happen to be really good, but because you don't know them as a brand name, you don't put them in your top 25 to start, and then you got to climb all the way up to number four in the country to be in the football playoff. It's a crock. But I know why it is. You do that to get people to talk about your sport. You do that even for us radio people. It's great to say number two Hanover taking on number three Osborne, even though we might know that one of them isn't deserving of that ranking. Mm-hmm. But we're still going to plug it that way. So I know that sounds like a little bit hypocritical statement because we do use the rankings to plug a matchup. But I would be perfectly fine if we didn't. We could easily plug it and say undefeated Hanover versus one loss Osborne. I don't need the rankings to hype it up, but they're there, so mm-hmm. we use them. But Southeast Saline is up in arms like somebody stole their milk and their cookies and all their presents and the Grinch came and stole Christmas because they went from number one to number two. It doesn't make sense. I get it. But it doesn't mean anything. I have Beloit fans that complain about rankings year in and year out. I have other people in our area complain about rankings. I have friends across the state complain about rankings. And I'm like, dear Lord. At the end of the year, do you remember who was ranked in the last KBCA poll number one, Dusty?
No.
What do you remember?
Who was holding the trophy?
Who won the championship? That's it. That's it. You get to prove it. So use it as motivation. Use it fuel. Use it as fire. And go out and prove the 13 people that turned in their ballot this week, or the 33, however many they have, whatever week it is. There's tons of bias. There's still brand. We talk about brand name bias in college sports. It happens in high school all the time with these silly rankings. All the time. Well, when in doubt, well, you know, Beloit's got a good basketball program. Beloit football, I'll put them in there. I mean, one year I think Beloit football was ranked in the top three or four, and they lost a ton. And I'm like, there's no way Beloit should be ranked that high. But they were because of what they did the year before. And once again, there's no way in fairness to a voter that you know everybody that's coming back and everybody that left, or you don't know certain kids didn't go out for a sport because they specialize in something else. There's no way for you to know. So thus, let's not have any rankings. Let's wait a month. Let's like wait till Christmas. And right now, let's now start looking at, oh, that's who they played. Well, Southeast has beaten Heston. They've killed Abilene, and they beat this team, and they beat this team. But nobody takes the time to break all that down because it's not media that's voting on this. These are coaches that have way more better important things to worry about than researching the entire state to decide who's the fourth-ranked team in 3A boys. They have better things to do. It should be the media that does this. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, the media is very flawed because we only know, in fairness, we only know the teams we cover. So we don't know how great Sabetha is. I mean, I have some knowledge of it, but other people don't. People up there don't know how good Southeast Saline is. Well, you know they're good in football. Well, that doesn't mean they're good at basketball. Yeah. Sometimes teams get ranked because of how well they did in football, believe it or not. But it's all subjective, and there's no objectivity to it. And so you just really need to quit putting so much stress on the rankings. If you're a fan, if you're a parent, I got people throwing stuff out there. Oh, our team's ranked such and such in max preps. Oh, dear God, give me a break. Max preps don't know jack squat about rankings.
That's a mathematical formula.
It's a mathematical formula. It doesn't factor in many different things. Right. There's a radio guy for Colby that has that Max Preps has Colby Boys as a number one team in 3A. Colby Boys are number one team in 3A over Sabetha and Southeast of Saline. Max Preps, and he puts a guy out there who's new to the whole situation, and I get it. He thinks it's cool and it plugs the school he supports. I get it, but that is about one of the most hollowest things you can brag about, because Max Preps has no clue. The KBCA is better than Max Preps from that standpoint.
Absolutely, yeah.
So once again, take the rankings with a grain of salt, people.
I find it funny that a lot of coaches would almost, you know, secretly almost rather, they won't say it out loud, but they'd almost rather not have their teams ranked.
Yes.
Therefore, there's no, you know,
no bullseye.
Nobody's gunning for them or nobody gets up for their game. And, you know, but yet they're the ones we ask to rank them. And I get it. I'm, you know, I assume that most of them give some effort to get, to try to get the rankings right. I don't think they spend a ton of time on it, but I'll give them a little credit. But yeah, I think it's funny. Most coaches just kind of would rather not even talk about the rankings, but yet that's who we ask to do the rankings.
A lot of them, like I said, don't even do it. They hand it to somebody else. Yeah. I think sometimes they have fun and let the manager do it. I'm not kidding you. I think that probably happens.
Right, yeah.
They got bigger fish to fry. So rankings, Southeast, you did get scorned. For 1 week at least, but does it really affect whether you win a state title? Of course not. And don't hold against Sabetha, by the way. Sabetha didn't. No, unless Sabetha bought the ranking. And even then, who cares? But whatever. Are you tired of the ranking stuff? Every year, it's a passage of spring.
Listen, I'm not like...
I mean, I love that fans are excited and they want to talk about it, but it just seems like instead of talking about how great your team is, you talk about how jilted you are. It's like...
I'm not in apology mode for Southeast of Saline, but what I don't like about the rankings is if you have a set ranking, Southeast has been number one for like 2 weeks, haven't they? Maybe three?
Well, since after the first week, they beat Heston. They've been number one since.
Other 2 weeks that they've had rankings, Southeast has been number one.
And they didn't lose.
Yeah, and they didn't lose.
Didn't have a scare.
And so when I'm looking at this, I'm thinking like, okay, I know it's KBCA rankings, it's coaches' rankings, but how can a team just be dominating, win in every game, and then drop a spot?
It just doesn't
make sense. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing about it. And the fact that they were third last year at state adds to the fact that that doesn't make sense. Like, they have all these guys back.
They have everybody
back. They
finished
very high at state last year,
right.
And they beat Heston.
Yeah,
did you take account of who they beat in week one? Obviously, you did the first two times.
They just rolled a state-ranked Abilene in 4A, beat them by 20.
Yeah, and they're having no problems with anybody right now, to be completely honest with you. I mean, you know, there's teams that might play them close early, but they're...
Late played them tough for about three quarters.
But they pulled away and got the big win, right? And so they know how to finish. They understand... you know, what it takes to win at that level. And so for me, it's like, okay, they've done everything right. You had them at number one. Why are they dropping?
Sure.
That's the only issue I have with that. It doesn't matter. And I don't say that because it's Southeast Saline. If it's Sabetha that was two and doing all, or that was number one and doing all this,
stay.
And then they dropped to number two.
Right.
It's like, why? It doesn't look right.
Right.
But understanding that not every coach votes every week. And I'm guessing this week, a lot of coaches after Friday were checked out.
Oh, absolutely.
Because not a whole lot of teams were playing this week.
Going on holiday
and
break.
So I'm on break. I'm done with my coach duties for a week here.
I agree.
Now, I want to enjoy my time with my family. This is my break. I don't have time to do that. I'm filling it out. So I'm going to guess there was less ballots cast this week than more. And then that skews everything. It changes everything. Like, I help for KansasPrepFootball.com to do their football rankings, right? And if somebody misses and doesn't send him to Tim 1 week, then he can't count any rankings for that person. So that's one less data point as the college
playoff system would like to say, that's one less person that's put in rankings. So the rankings kind of change sometimes when you don't think they should, even on that poll, right? And so, but, you know, I'm, like you said, media is going to take that maybe a little more seriously.
Right.
And they're going to research. Like, I try my best to research everything I can when right. I'm doing rankings, but I'm not a coach and don't have another thing that's bearing me down, worrying about my team and coaching them and then trying to have to rank
the rest
of the teams.
What I should say, what I won't, I'll say it on the show, but what I should put back to Twitter, and this would really get people riled up, what I should send back to Southeast to show them how stupid the ranking, or okay, maybe not stupid the rankings are, but how silly they are, okay, is say, I should send a deal, and this would really upset Southeast people, but it puts it in perspective, doesn't it? And what I should do is say, well, how did that number one ranking in football, how'd you end up doing?
Mm-hmm.
Southeast was number one in the state all year long, according to many rankings. They were one or two in every ranking. They didn't even make the state championship. So, were they complaining? I mean, they didn't complain about being number one all year long. They got number one all year long. Then they didn't even make it to the state title game. Look what that ranking got you. It got you nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you played Kingman, do you think Kingman was like, oh, dear goodness gracious, we're scared of number one Southeast. That we can't beat them. They're number one according to the rankings. No, teams don't look at rankings. They might use it as motivation. They might say, hey, we have a chance to knock off number one or number two. And if nothing else, as Jason said, it puts a bullseye on your back as being ranked. So, you know, Southeast wants to be ranked number one all year long, but then they end up not making it to the state tournament. That really pretty hollow. And that's kind of the analogy I have here in football. You were number one all year long. You didn't even get to the state title game. And I know you lost a heartbreaker to Kingman. The bottom line is you didn't make it. So you want to get caught up in rankings. Would you rather be number one in a football team that loses in the semis? Or would you rather be the number two ranked Southeast Saline boys basketball team that wins it all at the end of the year?
Yeah.
Gee, I know which one I'm going to
vote
for.
Yeah.
But listen, one year, I've been told this story. I don't remember it exactly when it happened because I was in high school. But Beloit and Wichita Collegiate were number one and two in the state. They played in Beloit. I heard it was an amazing game, okay? They were number one, number two. Everybody had been penciled in. They were going to play each other for the state title. Ryan Eilich told me this story, as has Eric Eilert and others. So they were number one and two in the state. It was just a no-brainer that they were going to meet for the championship. Forget making state. They were automatically going, right? And they were going to play each other in the state championship game. They're ranked number one and number two in the state all year long. And do you know that neither one made it to state?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how great was that ranking? I mean, you know what? It's interesting. I don't hear Beloit people from that basketball team go around pumping their chest and going, hey, we were number one or number two back in 1990, whatever it was, at the end of the regular season. In fact, they really don't want to talk about they lost in the sub-state to Belleville. They don't want to talk about it. Just like K-State fans don't want to talk about the lost A&M, and KU fans don't want to talk about the lost Arizona, Northern Iowa, Bucknell, Bradley, and many others, okay? But when Kansas was the number one seed and lost to lots of teams that they shouldn't lost to, what did that seed get them? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Okay, K-State was a heavy favorite in the Big 12 title game against A&M. Did that win them a football game? No. It had to be settled on the field. Same thing with Georgia. They're going to have to prove it again. Everybody thinks they're going to win it again, but they still got to go out and prove it. They're not just anointed the champion due to an AP voters poll from the media or coaches. So we get to settle it on the field. And trust me, any competitor would much rather have a state championship or national championship trophy instead of being claimed the number one team going into the postseason.
Mm-hmm.
But yet people make a gigantic deal out
of it. Yeah, well, when you go back to that football thing, I think there's a thing with rankings that can work against you. And I think Kingman's a very good example of that, because I think everybody spent all year talking about Nemaha Central and Southeast of Saline.
That's right.
And Kingman's sitting like, we're here too.
That's right. They were under the radar.
Yeah, we're here too. And you could tell the way they played against Beloit.
They had a chip on their shoulder.
They were playing with a chip on their shoulder. Mm-hmm. And it got a little much there at the third quarter against Beloit.
Yeah.
With late hits.
They had a
tude.
They had an attitude.
Yeah, and they listen, I watched the game against Southeast of Saline. They played the same way. Chip on their shoulder. They wanted that game, and they wanted to prove that, hey, there's more than two teams in this state in this classification, and they did.
Yeah.
Made it to the state champ. Did not fare well in the state championship game.
Right.
Made it respectable at the end as far as the score was concerned, but Nemaha Central blew them out. But it's, you know, it can work against you from that aspect of, hey, they're all talking about just two teams. Like, guys, we're here too, and let's make them understand that we're here.
Right.
And I just the vibe that I got from talking even to their coach and understanding where they were at and the way they played against Beloit, you could tell that chip was there. Mm-hmm. That they're like, yeah, we're here, and we're going to let you know.
And that's what I'm saying Southeast Saline should do.
That's what they need
use
to
do. Use this as a chip.
Use it as a chip on your shoulder. Say, hey, you guys thought Sabetha was it, but we're here.
Like I said, if I'm Bryson Flax, I sit there and embrace it, and I use it in every single – if that's important to my team, obviously their goal is to win a state title, and it should be. They got third last year, and they got everybody back. If it's state title or bust for them.
Absolutely,
this year.
Yeah.
But whether or not they rank number one or number two at Christmas really probably wasn't one of the goals to start the year. At least I wouldn't think so. All right, got a few other things to get to here. It's time for K-State in Focus. Our focus on Kansas State athletics, brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. Well, if you want to brave the cold temperatures today, folks, and you have some time off, well, you can just make a little trip over to the Little Apple in Manhattan, Kansas. You can get a women's and men's doubleheader today. We're really odd starting times.
So you better be on the road already.
For the women's game. Men's game, you got time. But the women will play. K-State women are 10-2. They were recently ranked. Now they're not anymore. But they'll play Morgan State, who's 7-4. They're going to tip that off at 11 a.m. in 50 minutes in Manhattan. I was tempted to go, you know, at least go see the men's game because I knew I wouldn't make it to the women's game. But with all the weather, I'm going to take a pass for now.
Yeah.
The 10-1 K-State men will follow as they play 6-6 Radford. That game will be at 1:30, and that'll also both those games, the women's at 11 and the men at 1:30 in Manhattan for that women's and men's doubleheader, will be on ESPN Plus. I can't imagine the crowd will be that great today with the weather. Hauled. I mean, maybe it will be good. I don't know. But the middle of the week, people still there. Some people still have to work. Not everybody gets the whole week off. Well, some people do.
Yeah.
Well, we obviously don't. the K-State women and men playing today. Of course, there's a signing day. I don't even keep up with it. There's more than one now. Signing day for the football team. You can watch Chris Klieman's signing day press conference at kstatesports.com. See how many people sign and then change their minds and then transfer next year and whatever else. I just don't put much time in that anymore. Of course, the Sugar Bowl, K-State football team will be taking on Alabama in New Orleans at 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 31st. And I should also point out the K-State volleyball team still does not have a head volleyball coach, last I saw. They're still looking to replace Susie Fritz. So that's your focus on K-State athletics today, brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. The KU women look to stay undefeated. They're 10-0, ranked number 20. They will take on Nebraska, 9-3, up in Lincoln tonight at 6 o'clock. Sad news passed along to you today. Franco Harris, whose immaculate reception was a highlight in a decorated Pro Football Hall of Fame career with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and then later on he played for the Seahawks, he has passed away at the age of 72. Franco Harris played 12 of his 13 NFL seasons with the Steelers after starring for Penn State, was a 9-time Pro Bowl selection, 4-time Super Bowl champion, 91 career rushing touchdowns, ranked 11th all-time. He holds several Steelers records, including nearly 12,000 rushing yards with the franchise. He was inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1990. He passed away at the age of 72. Of course, the play that he's remembered for is the immaculate reception in that playoff game on the pass from Terry Bradshaw and Franco scoring to beat the Raiders at the end. And that anniversary of that reception's coming up here, I think, in a few days. So Franco Harris, unfortunately, passed away at the 72. No cause of death was immediately known, if you're wondering about that. If you're into college football bowl season, well, you already know what happened yesterday. Eastern Michigan beat San Jose State 41-27 in the Idaho Potato Bowl. Toledo picked up a 21-19 win over Liberty in the Boca Raton Bowl. One game on the schedule today, and I can't wait to watch it. South Alabama against Western Kentucky in the New Orleans Bowl. Good stuff. By the way, I have friends of mine from college. They went. They were tied with some sponsorship trip, and they went to Las Vegas because there was a bowl game. It was a Las Vegas Bowl a few days ago, and they went, and it was Oregon State against Florida, and Oregon State killed Florida, and Florida, with 40 seconds left, kicked the field goal so they didn't get shut out to keep their streak alive, which was embarrassing. Billy Napier, now everybody wants him fired at Florida. They already wanted him fired, but after that, they finished 6-7, did Florida. Remember, Alabama beat Florida. That's such a good win. But anyway, it was not a close game at all. But I have friends of mine that went to the Las Vegas Bowl between Oregon State, that was 9-3, and Florida was 6-6. And they took a picture at kickoff, and in the background were the stands, and there was nobody in the upper level. Not a single soul.
Yeah.
It was just like, what's the point of this bowl game? But anyway, I think a lot of them are like that way. The Royals added another veteran arm. We talked about yesterday it was about to be official. Now it is official. The Royals pick up right-hander Jordan Lyles. He's 32, I think? 31? I had it somewhere. Anyway, he most recently was the Orioles last season. He has an ERA of over 5 in his 12-year career. So, yeah, he's 30-something. I think he's 32. This past season, 32 starts with Orioles. He's 12-11. His best season as a starter. ERA of 4.42. 144 strikeouts, just 52 walks, 179 innings. He agrees to a 2-year, $17 million deal. Now, to put this in perspective, Jordan Lyles is now the second highest paid Royal on the team. And his career record is under 500. His ERA last year was his best year at 4.42. Put that in perspective. Let's talk about the New York Mets, shall we? So Carlos Correa, who I still don't understand why they're giving this guy so much money. But anyway, in a stunning turn of events, Carlos Correa has agreed to a 12-year, $315 million contract with the New York Mets. He had an agreement in place with the San Francisco Giants for 13 years, $350 million. He had agreed to terms last week with the Giants. He was set to sign the historic deal, which would have tied Bryce Harper for the longest free agent deal in baseball history. But the deal fell apart yesterday, and the Mets swooped in, led by uber-aggressive owner Steve Cohen, who told the New York Post that he negotiated the new contract with Correa's agent, wait for it, Scott Boras. And wait for it, they negotiated in Hawaii. How sweet. Correa was scheduled to be officially introduced by the Giants yesterday at a press conference, but the team announced yesterday morning that the news conference was postponed without providing a reason. The Associated Press reported that an undisclosed medical concern arose during Correa's physical examination, but sources throughout Major League Baseball said that they believed the deal would still get done. Well, guess what happened? Scott Boras then decided, I'm going to contact the Mets. So he told the Post there was a difference of opinion between Correa and the Giants over the results of that medical evaluation. So Cohen, the owner of the Mets, told the New York Post that the agreement with Correa and Boras came together quickly because the Mets were the final suitor. They were the runner-up to the Giants in the original negotiation anyway. So with Correa's deal, and this is, let me go back. The Royals just signed a pitcher to 2 years, $17 million. The Mets just signed a guy, 12 years, $315 million. Do you notice the difference in market size, Kansas City, New York? Okay, with Correa's deal, ladies and gentlemen, grab the arms on the side of your chair for this one. With Carlos Correa's deal now with the Mets, the New York Mets, not the Yankees, the New York Mets have committed more than $800 million to free agents this offseason. And their competitive balance tax payroll now projects to be at $384 million. The fourth and final threshold of the luxury tax, known as the Steve Cohen tax, the owner of the Mets, sits at $293 million, which means the Mets could be in for a tax bill in the neighborhood of $100 million next year. To put that in perspective, the $100 million tax bill for the New York Mets would be more than six Major League Baseball teams' payrolls, I believe it was, including, you guessed it, the Kansas City Royals. You tell me how we can have competitive balance in Major League Baseball. Hasn't baseball ever learned anything? They never do. It doesn't matter who the commissioner is. They never learn. All you got to do is look at the National Football League, the most popular sport in the United States of America and probably North America, all right? The NFL, what makes it so great? Every year, somebody does crazy things. The Jets are got a winning record. The Seahawks are 7-7. That's insane. The Packers have fallen to 6-8. The Buccaneers have a losing record. And then the Commanders have a chance of the playoffs. The Giants, who are horrible, are in a playoff spot right now. The Eagles, who saw them being 13-1? You know, all kinds of different things. We saw the Chiefs go from 2-14 to 9-0 the very next year and make the playoffs. We saw the Rams go for 4-12 to win a Super Bowl. You don't see that hardly ever in Major League Baseball, or a team with a really bad record just suddenly, woohoo,
not that
they're
quick,
winning it all. And how do you not want to copy the greatest sport in the U.S. right now? I mean, it's most popular, and they got their flaws, don't get me wrong. It's the National Football League. And what do they have in place, Dusty?
It's something called the cap, I think.
Salary cap? Yes, they do. They have a salary cap. And Major League Baseball does not. Now, that's the power of their union is part of it. Okay, there is a baseball is one of the strongest unions in all the world. That's a part of the equation. I don't fully understand. Yeah, I won't get into the intricacies of it. But the bottom line is this: Cody Tapp, who has his own show in Kansas City, I thought has a great tweet today. I don't always agree with what Cody has to say, but he has a good one. And this is what he says, and I quote: "The New York Mets have spent $800 million in free agency. I'm not even talking about the other guys that are on their team that are paid. We're talking $800 million to just guys to bring in."
Mm-hmm.
And they won 100 games last year. So Cody says the Mets have spent $800 million in free agency this year. Someone add up every free agent contract in Royals baseball history and tell me if we get to $800 million. I hate the economics of baseball. He's absolutely right. We had there for a spell where we were starting to get the teams, bigger markets, didn't like paying that luxury tax. They didn't like paying that tax bill. And then there was complaints, well, there are teams that are tanking. They're just taking that money and pocketing it, which, you know, you could make an argument that the Marlins have done that. Some people have accused the Royals of doing that. I don't think they have. I think they've tried. They just have a limitation on their ownership's pockets. The Royals have not been the lowest payroll in baseball or anything like that. They've gone out. I mean, they just spent $17 million on a guy, and they don't have to. They really don't have to spend it. They don't have to do a dang thing this offseason. Just bring everybody back if they want to truly tank and pocket the money. So the Royals, I think, are trying. 2 years, $17 million, I think, is too much for the guy that they're bringing in. But the point of the story is this, and there probably should be a salary cap floor, maybe, okay? Maybe the floor should be $50 million, $75 million. I don't know what it is. But there's got to be a cap. But at a point in time, the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Cubs, the Mets, Padres, maybe. There was a time where all these teams seemed to be very careful. They didn't want to pay the extra money. And then all it took, and I saw it coming a mile away, all it took was one organization to say, the hell with all that. I don't care if I'm going to pay a tax. I will win at all costs, which is George Steinbrenner. That's what he always did. I'm going to win at all costs. I've got the money, and I don't even care. Well, Steve Cohen just said, they were talking about, well, now your payroll is such and such. He goes, who cares? If this guy can get us over the top, it's worth it. So that's a winning at all costs attitude, which a lot of people love, because who doesn't want to win a title? Who doesn't want to go buy all the best players? And it's not your money. It's Steve Cohen's money. Mm-hmm. I mean, let him blow all the money if he wants and have the Mets go 81-81 next year. That's fine. But here's why it's bad. It's not good for teams like the Royals. It's horrible for the Marlins. It's bad for the Twins. The Padres and the Mets and the Yankees and definitely the Dodgers are four of the biggest instigators. But right now, the two worst ones are the Mets and the Padres, to be quite, and the Dodgers. Those three have now finally come to the realization, who cares about your stupid little luxury tax? I don't care. I'm going to overspend. I'm going to do whatever I want with my money. I'm going to win at all costs, and I'm going to go ahead and make it unfair for small market teams. I don't care. Not my responsibility, which I get it. It isn't their responsibility to hold up the small teams. It is their money. They can do whatever they want, but that's the problem that Major League Baseball has never reined in, and that is have a salary cap. Now you have more parity. Now you have more teams that are winning championships. You have more different teams that make the playoffs. You have a team that can actually go from last to first. It happened on a semi-regular basis, and you would have maybe a more popular sport because of it. Instead, it's just spend, 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 and while the Mets are signing another guy to a gigantic long-term deal, the Royals sit here quietly spending $17 million on a 32-year-old pitcher who has a losing record with an ERA over 4 last year for 2 years. You tell me how the Royals are going to compete with that.
The Royals are not going to compete with that. Nope.
So we thought we had that competitive balance closing a little bit back when the Royals won the World Series. The Indians were close to winning it. The Cubs won one. We had some, you know, Pirates made a few wild card one and done situations. You know, the Blue Jays didn't have a huge payroll. They were making the playoffs. Even Baltimore didn't have a huge payroll. They made the playoffs. The Royals swept them ALCS. We had different teams. But now do you notice who we're seeing in the playoffs year in and year out? It's pretty much the same teams. The Astros, the Yankees.
Dodgers are there.
Dodgers. Red Sox.
Yeah.
Okay, now the Braves have spent a lot of money.
Yeah.
Which they've been smart. They've signed
the
guys
long-term. Phillies have the money to spend if they want to.
Well, and they've got Bryce Harper.
You know, they got Bryce Harper to the big deal. And, you know, the Mets are a team that usually is going to challenge as long as they put the right team together.
Right.
With the money. It's funny because if you actually break down this model and understand how stupid it is.
It is.
If you're talking about quote-unquote competitive balance, you're going to get taxed more if you spend more.
Mm-hmm.
The rich always get taxed the most, right?
That's right.
Does that want to make them stop making money?
No.
Like, do they say, I got to cap it here because if I go past this, I'm going to have to pay more in taxes?
Right.
No, they keep making money and they make money and they make money and they make money. Like, okay, yeah, they're taking more of my taxes, but I'm still getting more money in the end back.
Right.
Than I would have if I stayed at this tax bracket or this tax bracket or I move up, right?
Right.
And it's like the whole concept of thinking that you're going to stop a big market team with a luxury tax.
With billionaire.
You're going to have to spend more money if you spend that much money. Oh, okay, I have money to spend. It doesn't matter to me.
Sure.
And so even right when that started happening, you knew there was this opportunity, this chance that it's not going to work. And it doesn't. If I have money in LA, I'm going to spend my money.
Yeah.
In a big city in New York, if I want to go get guys, whatever, $100 million luxury tax, who cares? I might win a championship. It's worth it. It's my money. I'll do what I want and pay the taxes to win. And so it's like nothing. We pay the taxes to win in corporate America, right? Like in America.
Oh, well, some companies don't have to pay taxes. That has been a contention of some people.
Yeah, exactly. And I understand that part of it too. But it's like, you know, it's like the American dream. You live, grow, get rich, right?
Right.
And so,
how dare you tell me how much I can spend?
But I have to give you all this money back. But okay, that's fine. Right. I got this money in the bank. We're good.
Right. Well,
we know you have to pay a lot of taxes on the Mega Million jackpot, right?
Sure.
But that doesn't stop anyone from buying
from
those
buying
tickets.
The lottery ticket, right. Do they?
Right. I will take the lump sum and lose $600 million because of it.
Because if I took it over 25 years, I'd actually get more. But I want it all now, which is what I would do because I could die tomorrow. So I better have a big party real fast.
You can
tax-free. But you don't whine about the taxes. You're right about that. That's a good point, Jason. I like that analogy.
I've said it.
Always comes back to the lottery with Jason.
Yeah,
always.
Yeah, it does. It's all I think about. Sometimes.
that Phoenix, Arizona, how hot it is.
Or right. Cold. Right.
it's 41 in Phoenix.
I think you should be taxing the other teams. Like if you don't finish 500 for so many years, you should start having to pay tax.
Now, see, I disagree with that immediately because if they're already, even if they spend $75 million and the Mets are spending $800 million on just free agents, how in the world are they going to have a good record when they're up against that type of
setup?
Well, you
can't catch. I mean, maybe record isn't the right.
I wouldn't go record. Yeah.
Maybe it would be some type of salary.
I like your original. A floor.
Salary.
Yeah, a floor. Yeah. I like what you said originally.
It's what your payroll is. Yeah. And if you're at $32 million and the highest is $500 million.
Well, then
maybe spend a little bit more money here.
But you know what's interesting? If we're going to argue that teams should be able to spend whatever they want to spend because it's their business, their money, aren't we being hypocrites if we try to tell other teams that they should spend more?
Yeah, right now you can't do that because you're telling the other people they can spend whatever they want.
Right. So why can't they spend whatever they want?
Right. But if you had the model set the way it should be, there probably should be a floor. You have to spend this much money
and a cap
where you can't go over this.
Yeah, right.
And if you do, it's more than just a tax. It's you know, you're going to pay for it maybe in draft picks down the line. You're going to pay for it and you know, less chances to get free agents, and we're going to mix some deals here in the future if you don't get that where it needs to be, the payroll. I mean, Warriors
owner's complaining all the time about paying taxes on what he spends.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's even taxes in the NBA.
Oh, yeah. The Warriors go way over.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you can still have that part of it, but there's more punishments if you keep doing it.
Yeah.
In the NBA and the NFL, right?
Yeah. Well, you look at Major League Baseball. Look at who made the playoffs this year. Padres had a gigantic, they'd had all kinds of free agents they signed and then got Juan Soto. The Dodgers, of course, have tons of people. I mean, they know their payroll is sky high. The Cardinals have Nolan Arenado. I already say his name wrong, but he used to be Colorado. Colorado couldn't keep him because they couldn't afford him. St. Louis gave him the best offer. Paul Goldschmidt, they've spent tons of money on guys that the Royals can't do. The Phillies went out and got Bryce Harper. The Mets, we already established, the Mets have almost spent $1 billion this offseason, with a B, as Austin Powers would say. Atlanta's got a pretty good payroll, although they've been kind of smart signing guys as they're younger to help them down the line. You know, Seattle might be a bit of an exception right now. Houston obviously spent lots of money on their payroll after they tanked for many years and saved money.
They're paying Verlander lots of money.
They played other guys lots of money. They let Correa walk, which was smart. What were you going to say?
I said Houston had a plan.
Oh, yeah.
And it has worked.
It's worked perfectly.
To the top level of any plan that's ever worked in sports, to be honest with you. I mean, it's up there with anything that you've ever seen.
Including banging on trash cans.
The plan included some cheating. But
perhaps. Not perhaps. It was. Cleveland maybe is an exception. Maybe they're an exception. The Yankees certainly are not. Toronto spent a ton of money the last couple of years on big-time guys. So Toronto is no longer this little small spender. Tampa Bay, I think, is the best example of all of them of being able to compete with the big boys, but yet they still finished third in the division behind the big spenders. They got in, and they got knocked out right away in that long game against the Indians or the Guardians. But Tampa, to me, has always been the consistent outlier. They're the only one that consistently does it. You know, the A's did it for a while. The Twins did it for a little while. The Royals did it for 2 years. But nobody's able to do it consistently over, say, a 10-year period, except maybe the Rays, and maybe it's been a 10-year deal for them. They're the only one that's been able to do it. And it takes superior scouting, superior trades, and it takes, I mean, they haven't made many mistakes. But small market teams, if they make a mistake, it just sets you back years. Mets make a mistake. Yankees make a mistake. Dodgers make a mistake. Padres make a mistake. Cubs even. St. Louis even. It doesn't set you back very much. And thus is the problem with Major League Baseball. And it's been that way for quite some time. And now we're getting to where it's the haves and have-nots again, after it seemed like we were starting to go towards, hey, maybe this is a little bit different. I mean, the Pittsburgh Pirates need a stud. But they're not going to go out and spend $315 million on Carlos Correa.
Right.
Neither are the Royals.
And here's the problem. It's
wait till Bobby Witt Jr. is available for free agency. He ain't going to be a Royal after 5 years.
You could put the floor and the cap in tomorrow, and we already had one of the better free agent classes that we've had.
Who's we?
As a collective society.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We just saw one of the better free agent classes that Major League Baseball's had in quite a while. We're not necessarily going to have that next year or the year after that. So now, even if you put in the new rules today, you don't get to help those teams out as much.
No.
These teams are signing guys for 10, 11, 12 years. You're probably not going to think about moving those people until year 8, 9, 10. And then it's just because they're a bad contract, and you're just going to move bad contracts for bad contracts or whatever down the road. So it's tough. I don't know if we're going to have a real good fix. I think it's going to be, we're going to see the same teams in the next 4 or 5 years over and over.
But here's the thing in baseball. When you go all in, like the Mets are and other teams, it doesn't work. You just recharge the bank account and then you're all in again whenever you choose to be all in. Whereas the National Football League, the L.A. Rams were all in last year. And I've said this for a couple of years with the Rams. They trade all their draft picks. They go out and get Jalen Ramsey. They get Matthew Stafford. They made a big mistake with the Todd Gurley contract some years ago, but they overcame it, didn't they? But eventually in football, it catches up to you when you lose all this draft capital and you're all in it to win it. And it worked. They won it. All you got to do is see what happened to them this year.
Yeah.
In NFL, you do pay the price if you're all in to win it, or you're all in and you don't win it, you do eventually pay a price. But why is that? Because there's more of a competitive balance in a competitive, even playing field. In baseball, the Mets can write off $800 million and go spend another $800 million next year. And as long as Steve Cohen has the money, it's no big deal.
Even the draft.
There's nothing restricting him from doing it except him being scared of paying a tax.
In the NBA, where we only have six or seven real difference makers a year that come into the league, then we have a nice another set of 10 or 12 players that come into the league each year. Those teams or those players go to the bad teams, right? And if you're go all in for 3 or 4 years, you don't really get those players.
But that's the thing. If you don't, as a big market team, right. If you don't get the big players, all you got to do in baseball is just go buy the ones like Bobby Witt Jr. when he's available.
Baseball.
That's the problem.
Baseball, the draft, is also
a crapshoot more than anything else.
It's a crapshoot, and it's a crapshoot that takes 3 or 4 years to even figure out if you got anything.
Right.
And then it also depends on money. They've messed that up a little bit too, to where now
it's slotted now.
They're fixing it, but it was messed up.
The Royals didn't sign people because of too much money, and signed players, drafted players because of signability under Allard Baird, and that was Allard Baird's decision. That was ownership that was cheap or didn't have the money, and they drafted guys they could sign based on. They didn't want to pay the big money for the big time guys. Now, when the Royals started to finally do that with Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmer, look what happened.
Yeah. So baseball might have a little bit of an issue. I mean,
if you're
a fan of these teams, then you're going to love it.
It's another reason why I don't like baseball. I mean, I love baseball, but I don't like how Major League Baseball handles
things. Baseball's going to have a lottery now. It's going to make that part of it worse.
Well, they had the lottery. They just decided they had the lottery. Yeah. The Royals were supposed to be the fifth pick. They went to 8.
Yeah. It's like they
didn't need to do that.
They had a lottery, and it's making it worse. Like, it's like, okay, you give a better chance.
We do that so teams don't tank for the number one pick. There's not an overwhelming number one pick like in the NBA.
No. Yeah, you can tank for the number one pick, but it's like Jason said, you don't know until 3 to 4 years down the road.
In baseball,
now, Bryce Harper would be an exception, right?
Sure.
Like, he started playing when he was 19.
Right.
But you're not going to get a guy that's a once in a generation kind of guy that's like, just going to come in right away, basically.
In
at
NBA,
that age
you have in NBA, you have immediate. The number one pick is immediate impact, whereas in baseball, number one pick is going to take at least a couple years. Usually.
NBA, you got tons of 19-year-olds playing.
A football number one pick can make an immediate impact. See quarterbacks or whatever. Baseball is the exception.
Yep. Yeah.
Baseball is always the exception, as I like to
say. Unless you're a relief pitcher like Brandon Finnegan, you know, like. Yeah. You get a chance to play because you have an arm that can come out of the pen. We're not relying on you to go out and start this game.
Right.
Those are the kind of guys that play that early, right? They're not thrown out right when they're drafted.
The NBA, you used to be able to just draft a kid out of high school. He might play fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. You draft a kid out of high school in baseball, he don't go straight to the bigs.
No.
It usually takes at least a couple years, if not longer. Finnegan was a college pitcher. That's why he was able to go so quick.
Exactly, yeah.
And by the way, how long has his career lasted? I don't even know if he's in the league right now.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's not like he set the world on fire. Maybe he came up too soon and that didn't help him. I don't know. But he helped the Royals, obviously, in 14. So anyway, the bottom line is the Mets have a lot of money and the Royals don't. Yeah, I'm just going to become a Mets fan now. I'll be a bandwagoner.
Can we get Don Hyland to start a team here?
Hold on a second. Oh, man, I didn't realize this. Steve Cohen is Don's stepbrother. Did you know that? Steve Cohen is Don Hyland's stepbrother.
Am I playing the Don Hyland game right?
You know what the movie Step Brothers? It's based on Steve Cohen and Don Hyland's life. Played by Will Ferrell. And what's the other guy? What's his name?
John C. Reilly.
John C. Reilly. Which one is Highland? You can figure it out.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.